Robert C. Ruark, author of a new book, I Didn't Know It Was Loaded, meets critics C.G. Paulding and Arlene Francis on The Author Meets the Critics. And now here's the man who keeps the peace on this program, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. One of America's most widely read columnists is our author today. Robert C. Ruark can be read every day in any of the Scripps Howard newspapers. His columns cover the American scene, personalities, gripes, anecdotes, and satire, every facet of American life, in short, about everything. Mr. Ruark's new book, I Didn't Know It Was Loaded, is also about everything. But here to tell us in his own words about I Didn't Know It Was Loaded is our author of the afternoon, Robert C. Ruark.
Thank you, Mr. McCaffrey. You said that Loaded is a book about everything. You might even call it a cosmic book, not a comic book, cosmic book. It trades in birds, bees, babysitters, crooners, dogs, actors, people with hangovers, people without hangovers, soldiers, sailors, women's foibles, trials, tribulations, and the horrors of both war and peace. Title doesn't have much significance. Well, not very much significance. It sounded to me like a title that might sell a couple of books. And it was given to me for free. Very few things, even book titles, are free these days. Apart from the gratis aspect, Loaded might be considered indicative of some of the things that have happened since the exposure of author to typewriter. You know, there are many people who have cursed the Egyptians for perfecting papyrus. Since it left the world wide open to the slants of people who write historical novels and these how-to-do books like How to Be Rich Though Poor or How to Vulcanize a Snake. Didn't Know It Was Loaded as neither historical hysteria nor how-to-do in subject matter. It is simply a book about everything, with short paragraphs and occasional profanity. It translates easily into other languages, such as Spanish. The title in that one would be No Sabía Que Estaba Cargada, which is all right with me. And for the first time, I see we have a pretty critic here. Allow me to commend you, Mr. McCaffrey. The last one had a spade beard.
Taking the name of Mr. Eugene O'Neill in
vain. As I can.
Yeah. Well, now, Mr. Ruark, you have a reputation for pulling no punches, so I'm sure you're ready to meet your critics head-on. I'm sure that your first critic will agree with you that you must have gotten your title for nothing, that it probably was worth nothing, if I know what his point of view is. He is the former managing editor of Commonweal Magazine, the distinguished reviewer and editor, Mr. C.G. Paulding.
Well, if this is a funny book, that's all right. Nobody can argue about whether a book's funny or not. You laugh or you don't laugh. But Mr. Ruark likes hard, strong language. He's a very tough man. He likes to use a word, I think, about himself, gutsy, G-U-T-S-Y, and off the record. He likes to be strong. And I think that the trouble is that he's like a man in a great big brand new automobile painted red like a fire engine who says, I know all about the green lights and the red lights. They mean nothing to me, or the one-way streets mean nothing to me. I say what I think. I go where I want to. Nobody's going to stop me. No copper's ever going to stop me. And he goes off. But by a very happy coincidence for him, every time there's a red light, he's busy changing the ribbon on his typewriter or something. So when he gets started again, there's a green light. And he goes tearing around a corner, daredevil, but it happens to be the right-way street. And even when he parks, it's never in front of a hydrant. I think that's the trouble with the book. It's a great, big, brave book of a man crusading against cosmetics. It's like a dog. Mr. Ruark loves dogs, and he's got a particularly filthy chapter about dogs we won't be able to mention again this afternoon, so I might as well get it in now. To make a nice metaphor out of that chapter, he's like a beautiful hunting dog, a pointer, who suddenly stops, trembles, gets all tense, shakes all over, and's found pointing rigidly at a butterfly.
Well, now, here with quite a different point of view is the lovely star of stage, screen, and radio, Miss Arlene Francis.
I think Mr. Paulding just really kind of took my side in a way because of the way he said he starts and he does something and then he stops at the right time, even though he doesn't know it's the right time. I think that's kind of a plug for the book, Mr. Paulding.
I think it's the wrong time for a man who sounds so strong and brave.
Well, I'll tell you now. I want to tell you the reason that I did like I Didn't Know It Was Loaded. And that is that Mr. Ruark, although he's a Southerner, he brings a vividness and an energy to his writing, usually associated with the North, due to the climate, of course. His insight and his perceptions are absolutely original for me, and the zest for life which his work displays, especially New York life, makes me look around at our town with kind of a new interest and a pleasure at being part of it. He's as vigorous as a born New Yorker. And I liked it because perhaps I feel a little surfeited with the talented but tender Truman Capotes, and therefore find myself very susceptible to the masculine vigor of Mr. Ruark. And while I don't always share his prejudices, I enjoy enormously the angry self-confidence of his viewpoint and his satiric comment on the foibles of our day. He writes with a kind of robust humor that makes the reader quite certain that if Mr. Ruark were to blow his top about anything, the explosion would be the result of laughing gas. And I think that's a good way to feel when you read a book.
Well, Miss Francis, I think that loud noise you heard was the noise of a million radios south of the Mason and Dixon line being turned off. I think that the South feels that the climate has nothing to do with producing strong, virile men of the Ruark type.
Oh, I don't mean that they don't produce strong, virile men. Don't misunderstand. Stand me. Oh,
of the
no.
Ruark type.
Of the Ruark type. I know about that Southern comfort. I think it's just fine, but it is slower.
Well, Mr. Paulding, do you wish to comment on this obvious crush that Miss Francis has developed on Mr. Ruark?
Well, my only comment is I wonder why she isn't in his book. Perhaps she is. Perhaps I missed him.
I got a sequel coming up.
I think we can assure you of a chapter, Miss Francis.
I'm sure you can, because the book is absolutely filled with all Mr. Ruark's friends, every single one of them.
Well,
and as for
fun.
This vigorous New York, it seems to be terribly vigorous on the side of all his friends. They're all there. He writes, now I don't want to be unjust when I talk about his being so tough, but in his very preface, he says, every time I touch a typewriter, I get into trouble. Now, I don't think he does get into trouble in this book. I know he has in his columns, and I respect him for his columns. But in this book, he gets into trouble by attacking all the things that everybody attacks without even being particularly tough. He attacks cosmetics and perfumes for men particularly, which I don't think is going to get him into much trouble with many men. He attacks the new look for women. Well, after all, if women don't like what he says about the new look, that isn't very terrible. He attacks the comics, which everybody's attacking. He attacks the radio. I don't know why he's here, but he has got a few friends on the radio. He attacks Vogue, which never was supposed to be reading for man, and if a man reads Vogue and gets mad at it, that isn't very surprising either. He attacks jukeboxes. He attacks, he dashes gallantly through a lot of open gates, really. But in the course of it, even a man as prudent as Mr. Ruark is in this book, but not everywhere else, this book, I think, is a special selection for genteel people. I think this book is the sort of thing that used to come out in the Atlantic Monthly on Harper's in about 1890. Nice essays on current things, like an attack on the waltz when it first came in. Highly unpopular and very brave. But it is in a new language. It's in the tough language. It's in a language which is the most appalling snobbishness that I've ever heard of. A lot of people use slang, but nobody in the world can't write one line without using slang. The New Yorkese that you hear about, and it's filled in this book, is an occasional kind of word that comes up. People don't talk in it all the time, unless you're creating a character, and then it's, but he's talking in the first person, and he has no business talking in this tough. He takes a drink, snarls out of the side of his mouth, and comes up with saying he likes Arthur Godfrey. Well, you don't have to go through all that preparation to like a very good man on the radio, for heaven's sakes. But in spite of that prudence, if I may go on just 1 minute
just
more.
Just a minute is all I'm going to give you.
That's right, Mr.
He does occasionally say something, a dirty little crack, that I presume reveals some of the background of his mind. For instance, he has a charming little passage about skiing. He doesn't like anybody who skis. But why, in heaven's name, does he have to say that you pay a king's ransom to take lessons from Nazi expatriates with a little Edelweiss stuck in their hats. That's a pretty dirty thing to say about ski instructors who are not Nazi expatriates in great numbers.
Well, it's an Edelweiss. You'll agree with that. Miss Francis?
I don't know. He's very vehement, this Mr. Spaulding, and a very good talker.
Without the S.
Spaulding.
I've changed your name. I didn't want everybody to know how you felt about this book. I don't know why you continually complain about the fact that he attacks. I think that if that is done with great good humor, it's rather amusing. After all, he speaks about subjects that we all know about. He speaks about horse races and hangovers and all the things that Mr. Ruach already has stated to the audience. And it seems to me that Aristotle, if I may quote him... inaccurately, I'm sure. I better be careful with you. Maybe it was Plato. I may set off the torch to a Greek revolution here. But anyway, I believe he said that one of the attributes of a work of art, thank you, Mr. Ruach, you're welcome, is the pleasure of recognition. And I think that's why I enjoyed this book so much. And it isn't so much that I found myself in it or that I resent that I didn't find my name in it, but it's because all these things are very familiar to me, and I think that all the things he writes about are very familiar to all the people that read books. He hasn't intended to write a serious book. He has written a humorous treatise, a series of essays on the life around us today. And I think anybody that has gone through the business of, for example, in one of his articles, buying one of those big Hollywood beds, and then the distress and agony he has finding spreads for it and sheets for it and trying to get it all covered at once, he does it very amusingly. He says, for example, that putting a sheet on one of those beds is like trying to put a pajama on a battleship. And I sort of enjoyed that little comment.
I did, too. I think that's part of the rare parts of his good, clean fun. You see, I have to pick and choose about what I talk about because a certain proportion of this book cannot be spoken of on this medium of communication.
Oh, Mr. Balding is sitting here and selling copies like wildfire. And I think now that we should hear from our author, if I didn't know it was loaded, Mr. Robert C. Ruart.
I sit here sort of torn between two points of, I can't make a personal attack on Mr. Paulding beyond saying that he looks like a frustrated skier. And, Miss Francis is getting more beautiful by the moment. I'm glad she mentioned that thing about Capote. And I'm also glad Mr. Paulding didn't think to use it adversely because that would have sent me crushed away from the microphone. My bangs haven't done very well lately. I can't get them down here. Concerning what I presume to be an assumption of gutter English on the part of this magnificent prose by Mr. Paulding, I remember a couple of words in there, some old conjunctions and verbs and a couple of adjectives or two that didn't seem to be all straight out of Dashiell Hammett. I used the word joie de vivre in there, I think, one time, and all sorts of erudite things. As concerns the quarrelsome aspect of it, the fact that I'm running around on these lower gauge, on a narrow gauge or lower case crusades of mine, I think that somebody should do it, and it's a thing that never ends, like having families. As long as everybody confines his barbs for Henry Wallace and the high cost of living, things get pretty dull in the writing business. Somebody should get mad at the fact that the hemline never makes up its mind whether to stay 18 inches off the deck or 13 inches off the deck.
Or the ceiling.
Or the ceiling. And I think it's a horrid thing when... Big business brings out a line of perfume for small boys who, goodness knows, have difficulty enough in this world. Concerning the dog, I think he called it an especially filthy chapter. It wasn't a filthy chapter, unless that was being filthy in a critical sense, Mr. Paulding.
It may have been in my mind. I don't guarantee that, but I got a lot out of that chapter.
Dogs have foibles. Dogs have foibles like people have foibles. This one dog I spoke of has certainly a Hitler complex.
Now, Mr. Ruart, keep off those dogs. I've warned you, it's better not to talk about them.
Well, I think we should mention, as far as the dogs are concerned, that one of these dogs that Mr. Ruark, this is the kind of acquaintanceship he has that even among dogs, Mr. Ruark knew a dog that had a mink coat and a diamond-studded collar.
I go
and went to
with
a psychoanalyst.
A very good class of dogs.
Well, I just want to get anybody who thinks that this book is true, I just add that, throw that statement in. If anything is true, then that statement's true in the book, and there you are.
Let us progress to skiing for a second.
This conversation is going downhill fast.
Skiing is a form of applied, sadism, I suppose, that is inflicted on other people for gain and for amusement. It is like pulling the wings off butterflies, a thing of which I disapprove. Skiers are very smug people. Just because they can sail off the side of a mountain and not break their neck, they feel that they must inflict that on everybody who crosses their path. And they are relentless in the infliction of same. I don't like skiers. I don't like ski instructors. Ski instructors always yodel and bard after the third thing.
But you don't have to call them Nazis all the same. I think
most
that's
of the ones I met left just ahead of the third.
Well, now, Mr. Ruark, would you say that you had no friends at all who had tendencies to yodel in bars, whether they were ski instructors or not, or reasonable facsimiles of yodeling in bars? I mean,
My friends don't yodel.
They don't, well?
They sing tender, poignant ditties like "That Old Girl of Mine."
I'll take the yodeling.
And the Whip and Poof song.
Frankly.
But may I take something more serious than this? Because I'm not going to let Mr. Ruark get away with talking about his dislike for skiing. Listen, in this book, there are just brief little things where he does touch on important things. There's a passage, I quote, "Because a hungry American is just as hungry as a hungry Frenchman, Englishman, or Greek. And when are we going to start a mission for the relief of peace-torn Yankees?" Now, that he attributes that statement to Mama. That doesn't let him out from having brought in a nasty little bit of isolationism, a nasty little bit of anti-martial plan, a nasty little bit of anti-foreign business, which he promptly follows up by talking about a chop house, which he likes tremendously, and he says that there in that chop house there's no such thing as continental service, which he apparently thinks is fancy service, whereas that's an extremely sort of absurd remark about Europe, where vast numbers of people eat in simple restaurants. I don't see why that doesn't show more nasty foreign feeling. He follows that up with a statement, again from the dog chapter, in which he compares England to a frustrated dog who's had a rotten life and who turns sour against its benefactors and is obliged to beg. Those little indications seem to me very painful for the ideological background of Mr. Ruark's book, which, after all, is of some interest. Let's
find out how interested Mr. Ruark is in your comments on his ideological background.
Well, I was not confusing ideology with the business of filling a stomach in the thing on the restaurant. I presume that Mr. Pauling is fascinated by the New York spectacle of eating, which in the better establishments, which means that you have to kiss Billingsley, shall we say, coming in.
Not bad either.
Say hello to three head waiters, be escorted to a room by some semi-demi head waiters, whereupon a captain takes your order wrong. You then deal strictly with waiters, except when you call the busboy by mistake, and I've never learned to differentiate one from the other. I kind of like a place where you can go in, sit down, holler at the kitchen, and get fed without a...
Well, you like a place, another place in your book, which is called Daniel's Restaurant, which had pickets outside it, and I'm perfectly willing to agree, perhaps they shouldn't have been there, but you think that's a wonderful example of labor-employee relations. You think that's a wonderful place because it didn't have a union in it. These are little bits of details, but they seem to me...
Pardon me, sir, but how do you feel on the subject of free speech?
Why, I like free speech very much.
How do you feel about free employment and things like that?
Ah, I think you're falling into the trap. I think that you don't like labor unions very much.
I think we ought to get off this subject. It's not about the book. I didn't know it was
loaded. It's all in the book.
But
you read the book.
No, Mr. Pauling, I think
you're saying it was loaded.
It's loaded like dice.
It's in the book in such little... After all, Mr. Ruach, I don't believe, has set out to do any propaganda in his book. These are some little ideas that have come to him that he gets sort of a bit astute about, but I don't think that they're terribly important. I think that the important thing about this book is that it is chock full of wonderful good humor, and that if you're not laughing at it out loud, which I found myself doing several times, you sort of are sitting there like a cat that swallowed a canary and are enjoying the rest of it. Certainly, we can always pick on little chapters and little things in people's books that we don't like, but the overall picture of this book is not one of anti-labor or anti-union or anti-British or anti-anything else. You have to, if you feel very strongly on that subject, I think you ought to not read books like Mr. Ruach's. I think they made a terrible mistake with you, Mr. Paulding.
I would like to call to Mr. Paulding's attention one of Mr. Ruach's chapters. You talked about his use of slang, Mr. Paulding, but there is a chapter which seemed to me a wonderful parody on the use of slang, particularly by Hollywood-type characters. Do you remember Chapter 17, It's Only Money, Baby? If I might quote from the beginning of that chapter, the opening paragraph, which I thought was quite engaging, is, "Here I am in my violet slacks and my yellow sports shirt and my dark glasses with the little holes in the panes so I can scratch my eyes if they itch. Just sitting in my green convertible and living every minute, baby, living every minute." Well, now, that seemed to me to have a rich, wonderful flavor. Perhaps it's aroma, I don't know, but rich and wonderful. I thought the whole chapter was a swell job.
I agree with you absolutely, but I think there's a place for that kind of language in its content and other places where it's seriously out of content. Now, in the chapter, if you're going to look up some chapters, there's that lovely one about where he lived in New York, which
is... 154th Street, yeah.
Oh, no, he lived down opposite the old gay 90s.
That's
there.
54th Street.
Oh, I thought you said 154th.
Oh, he'd never be up at 154th.
He never would. No. He never would get that far. I thought you were defending him.
I am, but I think he belongs on 54th Street. He's that kind of a writer. Gay, well, breezy.
Yeah, but it's awfully a circle of friends. I mean, that chapter is there again. He takes another
drink. I can't choose my friends. This man is a real autocrat.
No, that's a good
comeback.
You
want to choose my friends for me?
No, but I don't want you to be snobbish about them. And I think that to take up what McCaffrey said about when slang was good and when it wasn't, I think it's awfully displeasing to me when you talk about a very prominent actress whose name I will not mention, although you mention it right out in the book, and say that you don't think she was ever loaded or had a load when she went on the stage, but even if she were stiff, she were better than all the others. Somehow, that's you talking, and I think that's sort of rough talk.
You ought to hear her talk some.
We'll take your word for it, gentlemen. In any case, is there any other aspect of this that you'd like to...
When you were talking about the serious, the little serious moments in Mr. Ruach's book, I think you overlooked one comment on books and politics that he made that I was... quite interested in. He says that that the people that are complaining about things that happened several years ago would have done better to complain about it while something could be done about it. So many books are written now on the administration that is passed that is revealing things that had happened during that administration, and that it would have been better if those books had been written then. He says that while they still had the Wiedemeyer report on China stashed away in the deep freeze, I reckoned it was pending a satisfactory deal with a book publisher. We will see it on Christmas 1959 when its timeliness has evaporated to the point where news becomes memoirs. And I think that's a very important point that Mr. Ruach makes in his book.
Remarkably free from slang, too.
Yes, it is indeed. He has his moments, you see.
He has his moments, and in that very chapter, he says the most incredible thing. Now, that about people doing things when the time was to do them. He mentions Churchill's book and says that Churchill wrote it for profit and managed to evade taxes by calling it an antique.
True.
But, well, it may be true, but Churchill certainly was pretty busy doing things at the time that he was supposed to be doing them. He didn't sit there in order to write memoirs afterward.
He was taking notes like crazy all the time.
Well, why shouldn't he?
Well,
that
Mr.
happens
Churchill
to be a book that you ought to, that is so magnificently written and so extremely important as history and as the record of a very courageous man. I don't think it should be... sneered at as having been written for profit. I think that's grotesque business.
$2 million is $2 million in my book or any other book.
What did you write your book for, Mr.?
Profit.
Profit, I see.
At the moment.
At the moment, yeah. Doing well, I take it.
I hope so.
Well, I think that its future is going to be considerably brighter, due principally to Mr. Paul.
I'm very, very grateful to Mr.
Energetic
Paul.
Energetic remarks about it. I can only say that you're going to have a fine time up in Boston.
Could we have you the next time I have a book?
Yes, we guarantee that.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, that was very funny what you said, but I'm afraid that there was something pretty serious in what you said, that business about popular up in Boston. I don't think that you can possibly write a trivial remark about Churchill and profit. Connect Churchill with profit shows to me a lack of historical or human perspective that just makes the thing, it isn't funny.
I think that's only true, Mr. Paulding, if you're writing something serious and you make that kind of a comment. But when he is writing a book that is primarily a humorous book and makes that kind of a comic, I don't think anybody's going to take Mr. Ruick very seriously on that subject.
My whole point is that the places where you can't be humorous, the places where it's just bad taste to be humorous and absurd to be humorous.
May I move in for a second?
Yes, Mr. Ruick.
Seems to me that if we ever needed any humor in practically any situation, today is the time. And that so many people are feeling so strongly about so many things that it is breeding an intolerance of expression on other people's part. And I'm being serious now.
You're quite right. I agree with you.
You can't have any of the delightful shenanigans of Archibald Roy Cohen's delightful colored people in Birmingham anymore. You can't have it anymore. It's bad taste. The dialect joke, which in some cases was funny and was an important part of our humor, has gone away. You can't make a joke about an Englishman or an Irishman or anybody else anymore without somebody rearing up on his hind legs and hollering. This is a thing that can't be treated humorously. I'm sort of against that. Call it intolerance on my part.
Mr. Pauling.
Well, I think you can make all the jokes you want. I don't think that was a joke, and I don't think you meant it as a joke.
I don't think any human being is immune from being ribbed. I don't care how high he sits or...
And I'm sure Mr. Churchill particularly enjoys a rib as much as anybody.
And has been one of the most accomplished ribbers on a global scale of our time.
Well, I hope he laughs his head off, as you say, laugh till he drops dead or something, when he reads the passage about England and the dog. The begging dog, is British... But can I get in one word, because I think I'd better get it in now. I want to read you just one passage where Mr. Rock really writes beautiful English and says something that our right of free speech and ribbing might come in. I hope you don't mind the ribbing. And speaking of my business, he says, if you're taking dough to write pieces for a newspaper and then start holding out the good stuff for the magazines and books, it is not long before you get an untender message from the cashier. There's a little old axiom about giving the cream to the guy who hires you, and if there's anything left, then it's all right to hawk it on the side. Well, I'd just like to say, Mr. Rock, that on the basis of this book, you don't have to worry about that untender message from the cashier.
Mr. Rock, do you want to make any comment on the cashier? Or
No, the cashier, I got him pretty well controlled. Be it cream or be it curds, newspaper gets it first, and if there's anything left, it goes on to more permanent paper.
Very good it is in the newspaper, too, Mr. Ruick.
Thank you kindly, ma'am.
Your columns in the World Telegram, too.
Well, I think it is worthy of note that Mr. Ruick, in getting this book out, didn't just take his scrapbook of his daily columns and put it between covers, add a foreword and an epilogue, and say, here's something new, novel, and different for you to read. At least he sat down, and although he talked about a good many of the same things, he talked about them in new ways and used a good deal of different material. How much of this material was column material, Mr. Ruick?
The seed of it was practically, 50-60%, I guess, but...
All redone and turned out in a typical Ruick manner. Well, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Time's up for everybody. And now, here is our announcer, Bob Sherry.
Today's program marks the close of the summer series of The Author Meets the Critics. We hope you've enjoyed hearing the broadcast and meeting such personalities as Sumner Wells, Henry Morgan, Harold Lasky, Cornelia Otis Skinner, Bartley Crumb, Ilka Chase, and the many other writers and artists who've engaged in these literary free-for-alls. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Robert C. Ruart for coming here today to discuss his new book, I Didn't Know It Was Loaded, and to thank you, Arlene Francis, and you, C.G. Paulding, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Arthur Austin. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.